Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Scott Clark. Thanks for joining us at this time, at this day, this time of the week. Each and every week, we get together with you and talk about something we don't hear about so much on radio, but we really believe needs to be talked about and understood, because it's about addiction and it's about recovery. We have a special guest each and every night emanating from our broadcast studios here in New York, all across this great land of ours, and around the world on Armed Forces Radio. Now it's American Forces Radio. We are politically correct, or at least that's what they call themselves now. But you know what? To the end that they do, it's still the same. Our soldiers, our sailors, our Marines, our airmen and airwomen still keep us safe each and every day. To that end, we thank them for being there and for listening to Steppin' Out Radio on American Forces Radio. Now, to our special guest, Gina. Hello, Gina.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, Gina. Gina comes to us to share her experience, her strength and her hope. We have we talk about the abyss of addiction, whether it be drinking or other drugs, and drinking is a drug, folks. Alcohol is a drug. We like to stress that each and every time that we have this show, because it is what it is. But there are also other drugs. There is gambling, there's smoking, there's overeating, undereating, so many addictions, so many things that we need to deal with in this society, where we can't stop what we're doing and it has a negative impact on our lives. One such person is Gina, who is so good to join us. She is here to talk about her addictions, crystal meth and gambling amongst them. Gina, we begin at the beginnings. What are your beginnings?
Well, you know, I grew up with a single mother, and we lived well, but that was because my mother worked so hard. And so I think growing up, I had a lot of, you know, downtime as far as just not being supervised as much as I probably should have been. And, you know, with that downtime came, you know, exploring trouble. And I was able to, you know, get into a variety of things. And, of course, I feel like I was, you know, predisposed with the gene, because my father was an addict, even though I never knew him. And, you know, I just started experimenting. It began with alcohol. Actually, probably before that, it started with stealing. And then it progressed to alcohol, and then to marijuana, and then to crystal meth, and then came the gambling. So.
Now, you start with stealing, you say, Gina. I mean, we talk about many things on this show, and I haven't really talked about stealing. Did you think of that as an addiction in retrospect and in hindsight here?
Well, I think it was a telltale sign of just what was, you know, to come. You know, some kids are just not, you know, they don't do that. They don't, you know, they know stealing is bad. I think I knew it was bad, but I just didn't care. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of started my reckless behavior early in life from, you know, 5, 6, and 7.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, what at 5, 6, and 7 is when you started stealing, and then drinking followed after that at what age?
Drinking started at 14.
Mm-hmm. During that time, from let's say 7 to 14, what was your life about? I mean, you weren't drinking, but did you feel lesser than, greater than, equal to? Was life good? Tell me how things were going in your life.
You know, I think I always felt less than, you know, starting life without a father and, you know, always knowing that difference from other kids and stuff like that. You know, I always think I felt less than. I always think that I never felt a part of and different. And, you know, I feel like there were definitely, you know, things that, you know, just were out of my mother's control, you know, that I, you know, that I resented about my life at that time, you know, mainly not having a father. And, you know, a child's mind doesn't work, you know, the way an adult's does. You know, we internalize everything.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, it's a huge, I won't call it a rainbow, but a spectrum, if you will, this thing we call addiction, things that we suffer from. And the umbrella of addiction covers so many aspects. Whether we're born, do you think you were born with this?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do, because nobody would choose this life.
Well, tell me about that.
Tell you about choosing or not choosing this life?
Yeah, because you know, I know that there are people who weren't necessarily addicts who ended up doing heroin, and that can be a very physical addiction as opposed to a mental addiction that causes us to use to get away and get outside of our feelings, where a heroin addict may possibly just become physically addicted to heroin.
I don't know. I feel like we're kind of predisposed to certain things, and we all have kind of genetic markers mm-hmm. in us, and, you know, whether or not that flame is ever, you know, set inside of you. I mean, I believe someone could be an addict and it doesn't hit in it, you know, the addiction is never put into play.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe it's always there. And, you know, there are people that are predisposed to it that, you know, that start late in life. I've met many people that say they didn't touch a drink or a drug until, you know, they were in their 30s or 40s.
Right.
And 10 years later, they're living on, you know, Skid Row.
Right.
And, you know, it's when that fire is lit, when something, an event or an occurrence happens in our lives, and it sets it in motion. And for a lot of us, it starts at a lot younger age.
When it kicks in.
Developmental ages.
Right. Now, from 7 to 14, you were not drinking. You were, I guess your progression of stealing, did that continue?
My stealing, my lying, I was definitely a master manipulator at a really young age. I learned how to manipulate the people around me. You know, that whole addict behavior, you know, was all in motion at, you know, at a young age. I was lying, I was stealing, I was getting in trouble, I was getting in fights, I was, you know, I was doing other things to get that euphoria that I later in life developed from the drugs.
Well, we are wonderful manipulators, wonderful actors in many ways, because we try to use our influence to get what we want, because
yes.
we want it now. We want yes. it. We want it now. So at age 14, when did the alcohol hit home?
I think initially, and this goes back to you talking about, you know, what did you feel like as a kid? I think I felt different, and I went to a house party with some friends, and there was liquor there, and, you know, everyone was like, here, have a beer, do a beer bong stand, and, you know, and I didn't even like the taste of it, and I didn't really want to do it, but I felt like if I did, maybe then I would feel a part of.
You said do a beer bong stand. Is that what you said?
Yes.
What is that?
It's a keg stand. It's when they tap the keg with the hose and they lift your legs up in the air and you suck it back through the hose.
Hello, fun and games. And that's that's at age 14, Gina?
Yep.
Oofa. So yeah. So then you started feeling the fun.
Oh yeah. And I felt a part of, for like the first time in my whole life, I really felt like, you know, I was accepted and a part of, and it was great. And it was something different than I had ever felt. And, you know, if I didn't fit anywhere else besides my family, I fit with these, you know, people that were having what looked like supposed fun. And it was great.
Now, this is at age 14. This is probably what, 8th grade, 7th, 8th grade?
No, I think 14. I was in my freshman year of high school. That was when it all started.
An advanced skill drinker. Yes, okay. She was a freshman. But tell me what happened then as far as that progression was concerned. Was it mostly drinking through high school, or did that take other forms?
Oh, no. No. The drinking was for a very short time. And once I realized, because I have a God-fearing mother, and I was always very afraid of her, not that she's not a good mother. She's an amazing mother, but... You know, we as children had the fear of God in us, and it was good. And when I realized that I could lie and manipulate and not get caught for drinking, I could go out to parties and say I was at a friend's house or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and not get in trouble because I could lie and cover it up, I thought, why not start trying other substances? And then I started using marijuana and acid and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it progressed out from there.
And how old were you at that time when you were started going to different drugs?
15 and straight through almost to 16, where it really took off, because it all started because mind you, it was very recreational from 14 to 16.
Mm-hmm.
But I was diagnosed with a rare condition in my ovaries, and they removed both my ovaries. And the night I found out the news and found out that I had to go in for surgery and that I was never going to be able to have children was the first night I ever used methamphetamine. I just thought, forget it.
At the age of?
16.
At the age of 16.
It was right around my 16th birthday.
So
and
a personal tragedy ignited then your use of meth?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, at 16, you already are going through all those, you know, adolescence, you know, things of, you know, feeling a part of and fitting in and all this stuff. And then to have, you know, the one thing that I feel makes you a woman, the, you know, the ability to reproduce was taken from me. I went into a spiral. I just didn't even know what to think. And I went to a party that night, and I went into the bathroom with some friends, and they had always gone in there, and I always knew what they were doing, but I just wasn't into it. And this night I followed them in there, and they said, oh, no, we're going in here to do this. And I said, I know what you're going in there to do, and I want some.
I want some. Give me some. Now, yep. Gina has also been on, I'm sure you may have heard of A&E's intervention show, an award-winning show, just a wonderful show on A&E that Gina was a part of. How much sobriety do you have, Gina?
I have been sober almost 5 years. January 24th will be 5 years.
We'll talk more about what intervention is about, and sometimes there are sad stories that result from that. But we have good stories. We have good endings, happy endings, because we have people who are now straight and sober one day at a time. This is Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Scott Clark. Thanks for joining us. Be right back. Steppin' Out Radio. Steppin' Out Radio, reality radio at its finest. I'm Scott Clark. Thanks for joining us. Our special guest is Gina of Intervention fame on A&E. I don't know if you want to say you starred, Gina, on Intervention, but you were a cast member in that you were involved in the intervention process, but it wasn't one that you really wanted to be a part of. It just happened, did it?
Exactly, nor did I know I was a part of until the day of.
Yes, we'll talk about how that goes about. But Gina is talking right now about her addiction, how she began and how the addiction began, and about the progression. If you think you may have a problem with drinking or other drugs or gambling or overeating or undereating, if you think you have a problem, you can't quit doing something that is detrimental to your life, to yours and to others, there is help. You can go to our website. It could be a first step for you. It's at www.12stepmeeting.com. That's www.12stepmeeting.com. When you're there, you can sign up for our free newsletter. Denise McEntee, our producer, has a wonderful newsletter each and every week. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line. You can also call AA. It's very easy to find AA. Just go to AA in the phone book, and there is always help if you want it. There is always help. Gina, we'll talk about how you got help, but first let's finish your story of addiction and the abyss that it took you. So we were talking about the crystal meth. You started with beer after stealing and considered that as really part of the process, right?
Correct.
And stealing begat drinking, begat pot, begat other acid drugs. When you found out you needed surgery on your ovaries and found out you couldn't have children again, the tragedy begat crystal meth. What happened? Tell me about that. What happened?
Well, I guess, you know, it's best described as, you know, from the very first, you know, I had really experimented with other things, you know, alcohol and, you know, other drugs and different stuff like that. But when I did that meth that first time, I was home. I knew that that was it for me. That was where it was. And
what did it do, Gina, that sent you home? What can you describe what it did for you that maybe the others weren't doing? And in your frame of mind at that time, because you were going through a personal tragedy as well.
Right. You know, it just made me feel numb. I just felt like I, you know, like nothing mattered. Once I did that, you know, that first line of meth and that, you know, that all transpired, I just felt like it was okay. Like I could deal. It didn't matter. You know, like it was okay. And I just remember it gave me a calming, even feel.
Now that's different from what we might have a description from somebody, a crystal meth, or what I might have in my mind of visualizing a person or doing crystal meth. I'm thinking up and at it, you know, amphetamine, crystal meth, up, feeling like I can conquer the world.
Right.
But was that the feeling with you, or was it something different?
Well, you know, it did. You know, it's hard to describe. I mean, it was a rush. It made me go fast, and it made me. God, I'm trying.
So
to really,
speed gave you comfort, in essence.
It did. It like I said, I felt at peace with everything. I just felt like, you know, it was okay. Like it didn't matter that I needed to go get surgery at the end of the week and all that. It didn't matter. None of that mattered. It was like I felt comforted, even though, yes, it's the opposite of what people say, like, oh, go fast and speed and all that. But I had all that, but I also felt very, very much at home, mm-hmm. and I rode that wave. And, you know, I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada, and in Las Vegas, Nevada, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Is that really true? I mean, we hear the motto, but I've heard stories back from Vegas, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of true, and you know, Vegas has its secrets for sure, and you know, a lot of things are socially acceptable in Vegas that may not be in like Nashville, Tennessee. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, definitely there was a accessibility to anything and everything that I wanted.
So you started doing crystal meth before the surgery, and then after the surgery, did it just continue? Then did you just pick right back up after you got out of the hospital?
Shortly after, I mean, obviously there was a recovery time and all that. But when I got done in the hospital and I, you know, everything, all the you know, sutures came out and everything healed, you know, I think that's when it kind of really took off. I had only tried it like once or twice the week before the surgery. And then after the healing process came my healing process, my real healing process. And I really just was, you know, off and out. And, you know, it was just running and gunning. And shortly thereafter, I quit high school and I, you know, talked my mom into letting me move out early. And I mean, I'm, you know, I am the master manipulator when I'm in my addiction, for sure.
So you were what, 17 at this time?
No, I was still 16.
16.
I was still 16. And, you know, I'm that much of a smooth operator that I was able to talk my mom into letting me do homeschool, which, of course, is BS for I don't want to go to school. and then after that, it was, oh, I can't do this. You know, I can't do this online, you know, stuff. I can't do all this correspondence. And it's just too much. And then, you know, it was eventually no finishing of the high school. And then it was like, well, now what are you going to do with your life? And I was like, well, you know, I've got this opportunity to move somewhere and I need to go do it. And my mom said no. And then I wore her down until she finally just agreed. And I just grounded into her until she just finally said, okay, fine. I made it make sense to her.
Did you think that your mother had any idea that you were doing drugs, or did you hide it well?
No, I think I hid it pretty well, because I think if my mom had known that, you know, being the Italian mother that she was, she would have killed me. I don't think there would have even been anything. I mean, I really don't think that she knew. I just think that she thought I was an adolescent and I was going through, you know, adolescent stuff that kids go through. And I think she was thinking, she thought that she was just letting me, you know, go my path.
Right. So you got the okay from mom to go.
To move out right before my 17th birthday. And I went.
Where did you go? What did you do?
I moved to Utah to be a quote unquote nanny for this family. Mm-hmm. And it was just a bunch of hocus pocus. You know, I went to Utah and I started using drugs out there. And I was in a relationship with a really older man that was in hindsight, abusing me, I would say. Mm-hmm. And because it was very sick, you know, he was 50 and I was like 16. And you know, it just all spiraled from there.
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but what happened in Utah is...
Just came out on the radio.
Yes, it did, and a tough go, and we'll talk about that when we come back. What happened in Utah on Steppin' Out. We'll be right back. Back on Steppin' Out Radio, Scott Clark with you, along with Gina, who we are hearing an amazing story. First in Las Vegas, leaving Las Vegas at the age of 16, and hooking up in Utah with a 50-year-old man. And crystal meth was part of the story. In fact, it was probably a big part of the story. What happened in Utah with this man? You said there was some abuse going on, but what happened with your addiction as well, Gina?
Well, you know, it was the first time that I was kind of out from underneath my mother's thumb in her household, and I kind of just went crazy, and I was staying out, and I wasn't, you know, I was drinking and doing drugs, and, you know, who knew there was meth in Utah, but they have a huge problem with that out there, and, I just took it, you know, to another level of just partying. And, you know, I was being very careful at this point because nor was I under my mom's roof, nor was I 18. So there's that fine line between, you know, 16 and 18 where you have to kind of dance real well because you don't want to get caught up in anything or get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. So you did dance, and you danced with crystal meth as well. From age 16 to age 26, right? When you got sober at age 26?
Correct.
Tell me about that 10-year progression. What happened during that time?
Well, you know, I described myself as a novice when I first started, obviously, with everything. And when I hit the meth, that's when I went full bore. When I was 18, I ended up moving back to Las Vegas. Right before my 18th birthday, I moved back to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm this kind of person that just wants more. And I started dating a drug dealer, and he was actually making methamphetamine. And man, that's when it just went to full blown idiocy. I mean, I was on.
You were snorting it for the most, but did you ever get to a point where you started smoking it?
Oh, yes. Oh, very quickly, actually. When I was 18 is when I started smoking it, and I started smoking it from 18 all the way to the end of my career. And I was with this, you know, drug dealer, and he was making it also, and, you know, I ended up becoming a felon because we got caught in a raid. And you know, that's on my record today. It's something I still deal with.
Right.
And, you know, from the age of 18 to 26, I went so low. I can't even tell you. I started prostituting. I started, you know, beating people up for money. I was dealing. I was just out of control. I was a complete mess. And, you know, I would try and get sober for, you know, times in my life. I'd try and get sober. And I would, you know, I get sober for like 6 months, 9 months, get a job, get cleaned up. But, you know, I couldn't keep it because I'd be in a restaurant and I'd be watching people laughing and I wasn't laughing and I didn't get it. I didn't get what they were laughing at and I didn't feel a part of. I reverted back to the way I was when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I belonged in the streets. And after a while, I started gambling. And the gambling just, you know, it took it into other felony charges, like writing bad checks and different stuff like that. So, you know, it was just a mess with all the gambling and all the drugs and all the felony charges and everything. It was a nightmare.
So you became basically an addict of gambling as well, and the crystal meth, and those two together, a powerhouse.
Badness.
Where and how far in debt did you get, and how far in debt was your soul?
My soul was almost, you know, I was in debt to, you know, I had some checks I had written that I, you know, my soul couldn't cash. But monetarily, I had written thousands of dollars in bad checks. I had written them to casinos, and I was looking at some really serious charges. Because, you know, it's one thing to write bad checks to a bank, and it's a whole other thing to write a bad check at a cage at a casino.
They didn't break your legs, did they?
They didn't break my legs, no, but they were quick to pull charges on me.
They don't break legs anymore in Vegas, but they do press charges.
I believe so.
Yes. So at age 26, when this all came down, mm-hmm. Tell me how it all came to an end. I mean, tell me what you were right at that point where you were at the bottom, mm-hmm. right before you came out of it.
Well, you know, I was again, you know, off. I was about 9 months off of a 9 month period of sobriety. I was 9 months into a relapse, and I actually thought I was doing pretty good this time around. I wasn't prostituting as much, and I wasn't gambling as much, and I thought I looked all right, and I was supposed to show up at my mom's house on Thanksgiving of 05, and I didn't show up, and I was missing for a whole month from Thanksgiving to Christmas Day, and in that interim, my sister had contacted the TV show Intervention, and she wrote them a letter, and they get about 1,000 submissions a week on that show. And out of all of them, the producers picked my story, and they said, my sister, they said, we want to do her story. And she said, but she's missing. Like, that's what she told them. And they said, well, when she surfaces, have her give us a call, and we'll take it from there.
And we'll tell you what happened at Intervention and how Gina got clean and what her life is like today when we come back on Stepping Up. Stepping Out Radio. Our guest is Gina. Scott Clark with you as we listen to and hear a story of a compelling story of addiction that finally finds its bottom. And through the show Intervention on A&E, 1 in 1,000. Just think of that. Did you say 1 in 1,000? And how much time do they get each week?
One every week they're getting 1,000 submissions.
This is the problem in earnest of what we're talking about and how great of scope we have as far as addiction is concerned in this country. So, Gina, Intervention got a hold of you. How did that work?
Well, when I surfaced on Christmas Day of 05, they told me about this, you know, place that wanted to do a documentary or whatever, and I called in and I talked to them, and they said they wanted to do my story, but of course I don't know it's Intervention, and I end up saying yes, and they end up, you know, accepting my story, and they come out for filming, and we started filming, and we're doing all this filming and
of the Intervention
and well, of the process leading up to the intervention. Mm-hmm. And the last day, I still think there's 3 days left of filming. They tell me I'm just going to breakfast at my sister's house, and lo and behold, I show up, and there's a doctor in the room, and she's like, you know, Gina, come in. This is, and I walk in into my sister's house, and my whole family is sitting there, and there's a doctor there, and she says she's been with our family, and I just had an adverse reaction, and I ran. I ran for 2 hours before they got me back to the house. And when it was all said and done, they read their letters, and they said what they needed to say to me in regards to my addiction and how it had, you know, harmed our family. And in the end, they got me to say yes. And the next thing I knew, I woke up, and I was in West Palm Beach, Florida, at Algamas. And it was pretty interesting. It was surreal. It was showing up in this, you know, place I had never been to the other coast, and waking up out of a fog and being like, you want me to do what?
Algamas being a rehab, correct?
Yes. It's a gambling specific rehab, and they also deal with other issues. And I was able to, you know, get out there and start getting real.
Interesting, Gina, that your addiction started basically with drugs, alcohol, and other drugs, and then actually you went to a gambling place to deal with gambling and then the alcohol and other drugs as well.
And the meth and everything, absolutely. It was a co-occurring disorder, so they, you know, they treated it as such. And I think they didn't want to leave any stone unturned with me. And so we explored everything, and I was able to deal with some of my deep-rooted issues, some of my past traumas and different stuff like that. And, you know, I had some amazing therapists there, and I was really able to, to recover.
How long were you there?
I was there 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. I really can't describe it any other way. And somewhere along the way, early on, someone told me that they got 1,000 submissions a week. And I remember hearing that, and I remember thinking, oh, my God, like, I've just won the lottery, basically. Literally, I thought, I won the lottery, and I did not want to mess it up this time. I thought, you know, so much went into what just happened, and so much anxiety on my mom's part, and my sister who wrote the letter initially to intervention, and all these people who, you know, just poured their hearts out and did all this. And I said, I'm not going to waste this opportunity and this chance this time.
There are so many stories of intervention, too, where the person just stays out as well. I mean, this doesn't work 100% of the time. But but through the grace of higher powers and people who help Gina, she did get sober. She did get straight. She did quit gambling. And what is it like today?
You know, today it's amazing. I mean, I'm sitting here taping this. I'm sitting here, you know, doing this show, and my mom is sitting here, and I have restored relationships with, you know, my family. My sister Deanne has had 2 children. One was only a year old when I got sober, and he's about to turn 6. And I am every inch of me is his auntie, and they both of my nephews just love and adore me. And when I walk into a room, it's Aunt Gina, you know, and that sound just, it melts me, and it keeps me on my path. And, you know, being able to be with my mother and go do things and, you know, be a friend to people and to be able to guide other women that are going through things that I went through and use my experience, strength, and hope as kind of a roadmap to what to do and what not to do.
Do you believe this as a miracle? We hear it so many times that I'm a miracle walking. Do you believe that?
I am absolutely a miracle. I am the miracle. And it's only for the grace of God go I, honestly, because, I mean, I see people in the streets and other places, and I feel empathy for them, because I feel like if anything were to put me off my path, I mean, that could be me. Mm-hmm. And so I have to stay diligent. I have to attend 12-step meetings on a regular basis, and I have to, you know, I have to, because my disease is out there doing push-ups while I'm in here, you know, being sober. And if I get off my path, you know, I know what's out there waiting for me.
It never goes away, this thing called addiction. One day at a time, though, if I do not use, if I do not go out there and gamble, if I don't use.
And something that's really amazing is that I will be on staff at the new Algamas Women's Treatment Center opening in Scottsdale on October 15th. I will be on staff there.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so, you know, kind of it's full circle. It's kind of the place that got me well and got me on my feet and got me, you know, my base, my start in sobriety. I'll be working there and I'll be helping other women. And how amazing is it that the place that got me sober when I was, you know, a mess.
Full circle indeed. Full circle indeed.
Now thinks enough of me that they want to put me on staff. So
thank you so much, Gina. It's been a great time with you and sharing your story. We thank you so much. And coming up, we'll hear from Rick Benson from Algamas. Now, at this time, we would like to welcome Mr. Rick Benson. He is the director of the Algamas Recovery Center in Prescott, Arizona. Rick is here to tell us about Algamas' unique gambling-specific residential program. Rick, welcome to Steppin' Out Radio, and tell us all about Algamas, would you?
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you, folks. We are a gambling-specific residential program in Prescott, Arizona. And our website's www.algamus.org. I think a couple of things that set us apart from a lot of other programs in the country that say they're gambling specific is that when you start to ask the hard question, which is, when I sit in groups as a gambling addict, how many of the people in the group will be gambling addicts, compulsive gamblers, pathological gamblers? I'll use those terms interchangeably. A lot of other treatment centers will then tell you, well, you'll be about 25% of the total population. We're very small. We have only 9 beds. We're in a lovely mountain home with some great views. And then we're doing group therapy and individual therapy pretty much Monday through Friday, half day on Saturday. We're supporting that with people attending Gamblers Anonymous, accompanied by staff. We obviously believe that treatment is about the process of self-discovery, and Gamblers Anonymous is about the process of sustained long-term recovery. At length of stay can run anywhere from 30 days up to about 70 days, and then obviously people are going back to their home environment. I also think that one of the things that really is a very sterling part of our program is the fact that we have a financial counselor on staff, a CPA type, who works in a three-part way with the drug of money for each and every one of the gambling addicts, both in group and in individual sessions. First, let's establish a complete look at the debt structure. Second, let's set up a workable, livable, modest budget. And third, let's derive a sound restitution plan. And when we're able to do that and we're able to stop that financial fire from raging any longer with the gambling addict, we're really assisting them on the road to recovery. In all of those ways, I'd like to think that our program is one that has benefited many gamblers over these years and will continue to do so. We're hopeful that we'll have another residential presence on the east coast of the United States sometime during 2010 and are working toward that objective presently. If there's anything we can do to be of help to any listeners on the show, including family members as well as gamblers themselves, don't hesitate to give us a call. Look at our website. Thanks again for the opportunity to be with you this evening. Take care now.
Rick Benson, thank you so much for being with us. Rick Benson, the director of the Algamas Recovery Center in Prescott, Arizona, here on Steppin' Out Radio. If you'd like more information on Algamas, it's www.algamas.org. Or call them at 800-818-4491. I'm Scott Clark. Thank you for joining us on Steppin' Out on this day, and we'll see you next time, one day at a time.